This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm talking to Glenn Nano. He's the founder of I don't think you can call this an organization or a business. It's a meetup called Code Meet Print, which works in the intersection of technology and books, writing, and authors. How are you, Glenn?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, David.
Thanks for taking some time to be on. So maybe, you know, since what you do is kind of hard to pin down, I think, you know, you've done a lot of different things in your life. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how did you get to the point where you found the intersection of technology and writing and publishing to be something you were interested in?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to talk about it. So Code Meet Print came about, I guess, in the beginning of 2011. I've spent the better part of my career as a technology investor, both as a hedge fund investor looking at technology companies of the grand scale, right? So public companies all over the globe, including Google and Intel and Facebook. Well, Facebook today, but not Facebook then. Etc. But then I had sort of made my way to the earlier stage of technology over the years. I think over time, my interests and my passions around, you know, what sort of comes next led me to think more and more about software and less about hardware and Intel and AMD and, you know, Dell and HP and things like that. And so I was working with a group that allowed me to kind of lead what was a seed stage investing arm called Centurion Venture Partners. And so immediately I was the guy, you know, just like other VCs where people would say, hey, you should meet this guy. This guy's raising money. This guy's got a great startup here in New York. And I just kept seeing great startups that had to do with what I broadly call storytelling. So, you know, I met with great people building, you know, things like the genome book, you know, so the literary genome, so to speak, or, you know, I met with people like Evan from The Atavist and Richard Nash, who was then working on Cursor and Red Lemonade, who's now doing great things at Small Demons. So I just kept meeting these great literary storytelling type startup and their founders, and it reawakened sort of my first love, which was books and storytelling. I actually have the college degree in English literature, and I spent a lot of my youth thinking about literature and obviously books, novels, poetry. I've even written some plays in my teenage days, so it kind of woke me up to this first love, and I thought, God, well, you know, as a VC, someone helping companies, you know, making intros on email or doing coffee meetings was great, but it wasn't scalable. And what could be more scalable would be to start a community. And so that we think of Code Meet Print as really a community first, online and offline, but a community which we call that, you know, kind of occupies the center or the convergence of texts and technology. So Code Meet Print is basically a community that explores, that defines, that prototypes, innovation around texts and technology. So that could mean, you know, like I said, having startups come and demo. We have a partner in General Assembly here in New York, which is a great startup tech co-working space and education space. So we've had all manner of startups like demo and kind of show the world what could come next, not just in terms of books and reading and storytelling and experiences, but also, you know, business models and commerce. And also really trying to educate the venture capital community about really exciting things that are happening, not just around ebooks and retailing, but all, you know, all manner of behaviors that surround reading, storytelling, whether it's journalism, fiction, short stories, poetry, memoirs, and, you know, business models. Because at the end of the day, things are changing really rapidly, and so we don't just talk about it. We actually try to prototype it as well. So it's been a really great thing. It's not my main thing. I actually do have a full-time startup job we could talk about later called Answer Key, but Code Meet Print is very close to my heart.
Well, and it is sort of what got me aware of you as a person and a thinker. And so Right, just at this moment, I was, or yet earlier today, I was looking at a piece in DBW, Digital Book World. You get the newsletter, or oh no, and there, there was a conversation or a piece about the how many startups there are in publishing, contrasted to the lack of growth in the business. And I wasn't sure that I really felt that that was a key point, but I wondered if you how you respond to that. What do you I mean, this idea that the book business is whatever it is, 14 billion or 21 billion if you include educational publishing, and it doesn't look like a growth business even with all the innovation in technology around reading and, as you say, devices, whatever it may be. So does it, how does that work for someone who's interested in venture capital and the growth of business? Does that look like a difficulty, and does it mean that people get into book startup space simply because they love reading, they love books, they think it's really fun, or is this really a big a place where there will be a lot of growth in business?
Right. I think everything you just said touches on many things that I personally and Code Me Print as a community are really obsessed about. And I, if I may kind of weigh in on some of them, I think you're dead on when you emphasize that venture capital, basically private equity at the earliest stage, right? So private equity before you become a growth company and before you become a public company. I think you're right. I think if you were to meet the top 20 VCs today, and I won't name their names because I don't want to speak for them, but I would guess that if you were to meet them, and I have met some of them, they would say ebooks pass, books publishing pass, and largely I think they were what they're trying to say is content pass. And I think that that's a sort of central tension around what we talk about when we talk about the future of storytelling, right? It's content, as we all know, is sort of racing to zero. It's racing to free. We as users, like, we can't forget that we're many things, right? We're people who care about the industry, who care about, creating an environment where creators and writers can do what they do, non-anxiously and not without the pressure of feeling like, God, what were my grosses today? But on the other hand, we're also users and readers. And let's face it, many of us, whether you admit it or not, are we're just become we've become accustomed to experiencing and consuming content for very cheap, if not free. So whether that's a YouTube video, an article, a news article, a link to all manner of content, so image, video, text, story, long form journalism, you're sort of used to that. So I think that if you're sitting, if you're a top 10 VC, you look at that trend and you say pass. So that's definitely a tension. But I guess for me, there are so many innovative thinkers and doers that are trying to conceive of a world where that's not the case. So that's number one. And, part of my experience at Centurion and with Code Me Print is meeting all these people, literally, online and offline, every week, every day, and feeling like, gosh, these are some really smart people tackling really big problems. So I want to sort of be part of that if I can.
No, that makes
So
sense.
that's A, it sort of speaks to what you said. Well, is there a drive? But the sort of former investor in me, so on B would say, gosh, there's a difference between passion and sort of economics. So I definitely grapple with that as well. And I have my own opinions about where, the industry with a capital I is really thinking with their heart and not their head. And, there can be problems around that.
Well, do you think that, I mean, on the one hand, if you compare the book industry, as a, let's say, to video games, or you think, well, video games is going to grow and books may not, or though maybe video games will reach, you never know really what the penetration will be or when it will come to a point where it's not possible to grow anymore. But certainly compared to other big industries, the opportunities in pure dollars seem to be limited in the book side. But on the other hand, you think about, and this, it just occurred to me as you were talking, reading is a very big deal. consumption of information. We're not just necessarily now talking about the entertainment business. Often publishers think of, you know, thought of this in the last few years as a kind of revelation. My God, we're not just competing with each other. We're competing for time and attention with all of these other things that people can do. And that includes television and movies and radio, but all then the internet exploded it all, so that, you know, it's we think about the attention as that's the economy itself, is all about time. But reading is done by everyone all the time. The internet is really fascinating. I mean, people watch a lot of video, admittedly, but a huge percentage of the information you consume in the world today, if you're online, is done by reading. So,
absolutely. I think that was really the third leg that I wanted to touch on, and you put it really beautifully, which is that behavior is something that we need to consider when we think about how, you know, what comes next. So it's not just total revenues, and it's not just existing revenues, but it's actually behaviors and how massive that can be. You know, I have a lot of sort of ambivalence about behaviors that are massive, because as we all know, right? So Twitter has got, you know, 850 million registered users, or probably 150 of them, 150 million of them are active. Same thing with Facebook, probably topping a billion, maybe 20% of them are active. But the point is, it's just like a massive amount of user generated content, right? But so from a behavioral perspective, that is just disruptive in a way that we couldn't have thought of 15 years ago, right? So there's that period. That's sort of non-debatable. But what is the sort of economic production that comes from that? It's not very much. By all accounts, I mean, you know, if you took their own revenues, and obviously Twitter is not a public company, but they did sort of semi-disclose, I believe, in 2011. They were on pace to do $40 million in revenue and maybe double that last year. Forgive me if I don't have, you know, whatever the whisper numbers are, but let's just call it $50 million. $250 million in revenue when you have a billion registered users is not disruptive in a way that any big portfolio manager or banker even thinks about it. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
I know it's a lot of money, but really, like, do you know what Apple, yeah, do you know how long? Because I think they just did in the time that you and I were just talking. So that perspective, behaviors can be hugely disruptive and innovative without producing much economic value. And I think that that's a huge tension for all of us to consider, you know. And, I mean, I think about the New York Times every day because of that. You know, I mean, I think about content that is vital for all of us, not just sort of beautiful and things that we're passionate about, but vital and are struggling economically. And I think it's down to what you're talking about. Yeah, reading is central, and it's something we all do, and hopefully more and more, but it's the disconnect between the behavior and economic production is too large for us not to be like really trying to solve that problem.
Yeah, you know? No, that's an interesting point. I thought about this, you know, it's a kind of, what you're talking about in a lot of ways is cultural effect is disconnected from economic meaning. You know, the fact that people go to, the way that people consume information online is important culturally in far in excess of the economic value that represents, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to kind of sum it up. I mean, I think whether it's cultural value or behavioral persistence, I think all of these things can be disconnected from economic production and generation, you know, and that's a problem, right? For anyone in the business of telling a story and trying to charge for it.
That right? is true. That is, I think that's what, in fact, I think that's kind of that is one of the underlying conversations that is really happening among writers, among publishers. I'm not so sure it's happening among readers. And you and I had this, we had a conversation a couple of weeks ago at Tools of Change, just on the fly, where we were talking about the importance of readers as opposed to what the creators and publishers who are kind of product-centric by necessity are thinking about, whereas readers have a completely different imperative. And, you know, I'm wondering what you think about, you know, how does that inform the storytelling side, you know, that the people who tell the stories, are working in an environment that is created for them by the consumers of those stories. And the tension between, you know, how can I make this work as a business for myself versus what do people really want and what are they willing to pay for, seems to be underlying everything that's going on, at least on the publishing side.
Yeah, the sort of theme of disconnect sort of seems to ring true here across so much of what we're talking about. I remember reading a piece a while back. I don't even know how to pronounce his name, so you're going to have to correct me. This is the problem for reading people, right? So like, right. You sort of read things and you've never heard the name pronounced. So is it James Surowiecki or Surowiecki from The New Yorker? He's sort of the financial columnist. He has a sort of one pager every other week. Anyway, he had written this piece years ago, kind of contemplating the New York Times as a utility, you know, and he basically put out this idea that, gosh, you know, could it or should it be something that's just sort of like financed philanthropically? You know, and I think that that's an important question to ask about a lot of what we're talking about, because there are behavior models that synced up with economic models 100 years ago. But as you and I are noting now, like, those models are now disconnecting. And so potentially, in order to sustain the behavior model, which is I read the New York Times or I read, you know, I'm reading, you know, Vampires at the Lemon Grove or whatever it is I'm going to read today, that it's possible that the economic model that supports the creator of that content, it needs to be very different than it
right.
was.
Right. Well, what you're talking about actually is something I've felt this really strongly for a long time, that the pure economic model is not sufficient when we're talking about sometimes the public good, and that we have, the way the economic discussion has moved over the last 30 or 40 years has been often away from this idea that there are values that are great enough for the culture that the society as a whole might say we are willing to support those, even though the transactional economics won't work. And we do this with mass transit, and we do it with highways to some extent. You know, and as you said, utilities have a higher value than the pure transactional value, so they are protected from pure capitalism. You could apply that. It's clearly one way of applying that to, let's say, writers, just thinking in terms of the diseconomic status of writing as in general, that, you know, we say, well, it's very difficult to make a living as a writer, but that's tough luck. That's just the way it is. But if the society could say, well, we would like there to be writers in the world, and we want people to be able to feed their children who are right. You know, writers should be able to live at least reasonably well. Not, they don't have to be rich, you know, at the public's expense, but they should, maybe they could have just enough revenue to make a living on. And one way of doing that, for example, is in England, they have a thing called the public lending right, which is essentially a tracking of books, or a payment system for books borrowed from libraries. What it says is that we think libraries are a really good thing, but it is also true that when books are borrowed from libraries, the writer makes no money from that. We don't want to track that behavior and make it a transactional thing. We don't want to burden libraries with it. We're going to put some money in a pot, and writers will share that to the extent that it's possible to average out how many times their books are read. Sort of like a nonprofit BMI or ASCAP. And I've always thought that should be a conversation for writers in the context of the internet, where what I would think is that the ISPs are the ones who are profiting from all this content without paying for it. And their users, there's no really direct way of saying building a transactional system. It makes no sense. But why not essentially a tax on internet users on just a micro amount of money that would go to writers and potentially to publishers for it to make up for the lost revenue that comes about in the the commonly accepted internet model, which is most information is going to end up being free or close to free, as you said before. That is the way it is. We're not going to change that, but why not reward the creators who make all of this possible?
I mean, I would love to see something that would consider exactly what you were talking about in terms of a behavior, a model that we're in right now and that we're going to continue to be. And so when you talk about the ISP, the internet service provider, you know, I mean, first of all, I cringe.
Of course.
You know, we're going to be making a lot of friends on this podcast. But anyway, when you think about bandwidth and you think about the series of tubes, as was once said years ago, that the internet is, that really is the model that we're in today. Like, it's all about what's transferring, you know, between those tubes and the ISPs taking tons and tons of revenue for that. You know, what is your data plan price right today? So like, yeah, I mean, I'm a user and a reader and I'm willing to pay, what do we pay, $50 at least a month for an unlimited data plan on your mobile device? Like, that is an absurd amount of money, you know, every year. And so for sure, I think we need to be considering, gosh, what are the keys to sort of that gate and reconsidering why data is so important in the first place? Well, it's important because David wants to read a long form piece right now, or if he wants to watch a video. And you're absolutely right that we should be considering what that new economic model looks like in the face of that.
So, right. And of course, recognizably, we know that there are, you know, it's like raising taxes. You know, if you say, well, we should all pay a little bit more, or this should come out of your pocket because, and, you know, it's very tough. I mean, you know, it's going to be difficult to convince anybody that anyone, you know, that everyone could agree this is something that writers should be paid for, but no one will agree that it should be paid for by them. That's going to be the difficulty. You know, and writers, content producers can't go on strike. You know, they can't, there's no way of altering the economic equation to impose any differentiation. That's the problem.
Well, there isn't until we find it, and it's so painful for the stakeholders who, you know, whether they're carriers or, you know, digital cellular carriers or MSOs, cable companies, etc. It just, there isn't until we find it, and it's painful enough for them to sort of open up negotiations and their coffers as well.
That's right? True. Well, you could imagine maybe this is sort of pie in the sky, but you could do a class action lawsuit for content creators, anybody who's written anything or created any video or audio and it's freely available on the web, which you don't object to. I'm pretty happy with the idea. If I write something, somebody's going to read it online. I actually believe in that, the idea that the more attention I get, the better off I will be in some way. But it would be interesting if all of those creators used as a tool the class action lawsuit that said, we don't want this stuff to become, to go away. We don't want to withdraw everything that we've put up on the web, but what we want is for there to be a recognized compensation for it, and the pool system would work. That's sort of how class action lawsuits work in the first place. They create a class and then figure out a mechanism for the members of that class to get fairly compensated.
That would be one tack to take, one method to take. Another would be, to make this, I mentioned MSOs and cable companies, like, that would be where my mind would go, first of all, right? So we're talking about, we've kind of gotten into the place where we're talking about the piping and infrastructure you know, partnering with and sharing revenue with content creators and distributors, right?
Right.
So whether it's Time Warner Cable saying to any of us in the five boroughs of New York, okay, here's your package. So what the end user thinks he's buying is, okay, so I'm buying all this content, but, you know, who is the first person taking a cut of that revenue? It's Time Warner Cable or Comcast or whatever. And they hold the keys to HBO and to Showtime and to whatever, you know, FX or all the channels that that people want. But like, exactly. So we got to that model, whatever, 30 years ago. Why couldn't that model now exist? Okay, well, you want to subscribe to or purchase some sort of digital content from Harper Perennial or Penguin or Norton. Could we conceive of a time where you're first talking to Comcast or you're first talking to Time Warner? I'm not saying it would automatically be better, but before, why would you even consider class action? Like, why couldn't that be a model that sort of conflating the infrastructure with the content the way video and TV has done it?
No, that seems, I actually think that's a viable approach and sounds pretty interesting. So listen, I don't want to distract us from that conversation, but I did want to let you have a chance to talk a little bit about AnswerKey. This is something this is your startup, right? This is the business that this is all yours. AnswerQi. Maybe you could talk a little bit about it because it looks pretty interesting.
I appreciate that. Yeah. So AnswerKey, I mean, you know, the sort of personal story there is, again, while I was working at Centurion and just trying to help entrepreneurs around New York really get to the next level, whether that's from investment or just helping through introductions and business development and things like that, it became clear to me that it was time for me to actually bring something out into the world on the web as well. And, I sort of re-met a very good and old friend of mine named Jamie Forrest, with whom I grew up also. I guess everything comes down to like who you knew when you were 12, right? We studied Latin and Greek together. We played in a high school band together. He directed me to musicals, you know, when we were kids. And, he had become quite an accomplished software developer. He was still living here in New York. And we felt like, gosh, like the web is full of really great, fascinating, kind of cool things, but like the web of useful things was still pretty early, pretty nascent. And so we centered on this idea of, you know, on-demand services. So we sort of feel like the world, the internet that it has indexed, let's say products, is pretty well formed at this time. We have this company called Amazon that's done a pretty good job of that, and their competitors. You can include eBay in there for sure. And content, whether it's articles or books or, you know, tweets or what have you, has been pretty well indexed by a little company called Google. But we felt like there was a big gap in terms of people and their skills and their brains. Because sometimes you don't need a product, sometimes you don't need an article, you need to actually talk to a real person. So we started AnswerKey with a QI, AnswerKey, to address that big behavior, that big need. So we launched back in May of 2012, and knock on wood, things have been really fun and really great. We actually just, and I didn't tell you this, David, we just launched our redesign this Wednesday. So if you go to the homepage, AnswerKey, AnswerQi, we have a brand new redesign, which is a fully responsive website. So it adapts to whatever device you're on, and hopefully the experience should be just as good as the web browser on desktop. But so our first version of that is on-demand technology help desk. So let's say you run a small business, you're sort of under-resourced with time, personnel, or even expertise, and you're trying to deal with your WordPress website. Gosh, I mean, you know, you could spend 3 hours trying to debug a problem, or you can talk to an expert through AnswerKey on demand for a reasonable price. And everybody wins. So,
and it just occurred to me, something else that you and I talked, or that was a conversation in the panel that I moderated that you were on at Tools of Change, had to do with this idea of how could we create relationships between writers and readers in a different way. And one of the things that came up was this idea of creating kind of halo experiences. You know, would readers be willing to pay more to have a direct relationship, you know, kind of like the signed limited edition has a value greater than the regular print book? What could you do that would have a greater value for a reader that they would be willing to pay for? And it just occurred to me what you've built with Answer Key could be used not just for writers, but for anybody that I might be interested in talking to, not just to solve a problem, but, and again, this could devolve into, you know, kind of stuff that you're not interested in, but how about a conversation about writing with a writer of some stature, you know, where maybe I'm a writer and I want to ask for their advice, but maybe I just want to talk to them. You know, you've just published this book. The book may be doing pretty well. I've read it. I'm interested in, I want to talk to the writer. I want to have a conversation. Like, how did you figure that character out? And who is this person? And why'd you set this book in Texas in 1912? You could do that with Answer Key. I mean, right now it's anonymized, right? If I call, I don't know who I'm going to talk to. I'm relying on you to, your job is to make sure that the experts know what they're talking about and provide me with value. But I wonder if you could do a version of that with identified experts who I would be interested in talking to specifically because of who they are and what they do.
I think that definitely touches on, you know, where we see not just Answer Key, but the internet, the way the internet is going to behave in the years to come really, really will address those types of needs and behaviors, because you're dead on right. Like what you call halo experiences or the halo effect. I mean, whatever it is we call it, I think, you know, and I mentioned this in the panel that we were on that you nicely moderated at Tools of Change, and which was, you know, the parallels to the music industry. You know, I'm a huge fan of music. That is definitely a content that I consume as much as any other content. And we all know what the sort of recent history is in the last 15 years since Napster. But what a lot of people in the industry will say is, like, they were forced to adapt, right? They were forced to adapt and find new ways, you know, to make it so, you know, Sufjan Stevens or Beyonce could actually go and do what they do best, right? Which is either merchandising or, you know, touring and doing their sort of performative content on demand, you know, to make the parallel to Answer Key type of service. But, you know, and I think that for sure could be something that Answer Key contemplates. Like, wouldn't it be cool if an author who wasn't a New York Times bestseller to be presented with what is essentially aggregated demand? So if thousands of people said, I want to do a Q&A with this youngish writer, debut novelist, you know, maybe the publishing company hasn't A, been aware of that demand, or B, you know, just wasn't able to kind of be forethoughtful about it. But users themselves just said, you know, I'm raising my hand. I'm clicking on this button on Answer Key or some other site that says, I would love to do a webinar, you know, and I would pay $10, and now there's 1,000 of them, you know what I mean? And sort of aggregating that sort of person-to-person demand, I think, is what's really, really fascinating about what we're doing at Answer Key and where I think the internet has to go from
here. Yeah, I think that actually is, it won't work for everybody. It won't work for every consumer. It won't work for every writer, but I do think it's very powerful. And, you know, in terms of, since we see in the social sphere what, because we're all so alienated, we use the web to build relationships. They may not be deep relationships, but they are the ones that we have. And a lot of people who, the heaviest users, are really doing what you're describing. They're expressing their wishes and desires. And I think what you're saying is, this is a place where, you know, you can aggregate that interest on the side of the consumer and make it meaningful on the other side of that pipe.
I think ultimately it's noise and signal. And I think that actually will touch on so much of what we think about with the publishing industry and writers. And I think about with Code Meets Print, but I certainly think that's really the big problem with everything. And so when people feel like, look, we all go to Google first and foremost, let's not even like pretend that that's not true. If you're curious about anything, you go into that little search box. But guess what? There's I typed in halo effect. There's 16.9 million results. I've done some research on this, and because we invested in a company that at Centurion that was trying to solve problems around SEO called Altruic. They're doing great, great work. 90% of all Google searches result in a click of the first two search results. That is it. So who cares about the other 16,899,000... right? So, I mean, well, on the one hand, that tells you how important it is to, you know, surface in the first two. But it also tells you that, like, there's so much noise. Everything else is just noise. And so whether it's Answer Key or any other service that tries to say, let's cut through the noise, you don't want to read through 100 how-to posts by people whose, you know, expertise is skeptical, you're skeptical of at best. You sort of want to get to the signal, and maybe you're willing to pay for that. And that's similar for, like, if I want to speak to, you know, Karen Russell, you know, like I represent the signal if I and 999 other readers are saying, you know, we'd really love to chat with you. How can we make this happen? You know, we're not just the noise of people kind of bothering you on Twitter. We're aggregating in a way that's useful for you. So you, Karen Russell, can talk to us for an hour and make it worth your while and make it worth our while, and everybody wins.
You know? Right. And in that way, that's also touches on something else you and I talked about, and that is, you know, this idea that the concept of discoverability it's really a problem on the production side. It's people's desires to be found is what they're really saying. But the other problem, the on the consumption side, it isn't necessarily discoverability. It's more curation. You know, how do I find something, a reliable source of information? You know, let's say, what's the next book I should be reading? Well, maybe there's somebody you can ask. You know, that's another way of looking at it. Who can I ask? Who's a trusted advisor? That's what book reviewers were. That's what books, you know, your local bookseller who got to know you really well when you walked in. They might have been a quirky person and eccentric in their tastes, but if they were smart, they figured out who you were. And they would hand you the right book when you walked in. I heard this the other day from somebody I know lives in New York who said she loves her neighborhood because when she walks into the the little kind of convenience store, the person there knows what she's there for. She's a regular and hands her what she always buys. She's known. She appreciates that personal touch. And in a large city, which is a lot like the web, what you are looking for always is a neighborhood, you know, a community, a group of people who you can rely on, who trust you and who you trust. And that seems, isn't that what, you know, we're replicating our normal human needs and desires are being written on this large screen.
Absolutely. Again, I think that just comes down to noise and signal. Like, the signal will be, okay, well, I trust David. I've spoken to David many times. So if he says to me, Glenn, you've got to read this collection of short stories, that's already going to rise up sort of in my mental pipeline of the content I need to consume, right? But I think there's also interesting algorithmic ways to do that, right? I personally think that for me, noise and signal will be a filtering noise from signal will be a combination of, you know, from the trusted advisors who are human beings. And so Answer Key is thinking about that. But then Google has done a pretty good job sort of algorithmically trying to get you to the fact, to the point where either of those first two results when you Google something is valuable for you. They would not be doing their job well if 90% of them were the first 25, right? It's really the first two. I just recently, and this is not a plug at all, but I did just recently switch, at least for a trial period, to my very first Android device. So I'm using the brand new sort of Google Nexus 4, which is their flagship phone, and they've built a product which is called Google Now. And Google Now, one of the great features of Google Now is, like, it you know, if you opt into it, so let's say I have my calendar, my contacts, my email, everything, my Gmail account, et cetera. It's all my Google account. So my calendar, and I've opted into it, will say, you know, I'm going to be at a meeting, you know, at 40th Street and 8th Avenue at the New York Times building. So if I'm coming from home, if my meeting is at 7 o'clock, at 6:41, it will alert me and it will say, you know, you've got 19 minutes, and that's how long roughly it'll take, you know, given traffic conditions or the 2-3 train or whatever. You know, I mean, it seems like a little feature for now, but you can sort of see where that goes, you know, in terms of telling you what's the signal that you need right now. I didn't ask it to tell me how long it would take to get there, but it figured out that that's probably a valuable thing that I want to know.
I wonder if there's a really, you know, this is, I'm sure somebody else has thought of this, but why not combine those two things, the algorithm and the answer key approach, algorithm to as a bridge to expertise. So I do my search, I see those top choices, but I want somebody who knows more than I do to tell me if my specific poorly, maybe I didn't phrase my question right. So, but maybe I kind of have a concierge service that takes, and this, you know, I wouldn't do this for like mundane search, but for some kind of really interesting problem that's out of the ordinary, maybe I use Google up to that point, and then I get the expert who helps me figure out from the context of my question and the context of the Google search responses what else I need to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Larry and Sergey would say we are going to get to the point where you never need anything. and they've done a really good job in the last 13 years getting us close to that point, right? But I think that what you're saying definitely sits with probably how I think about it, which is that the more and more important something is to you, so the bigger the pain point or the more important the event or the situation, the more you're actually going to want a human being who, you know, who has a heart and a head and has had human experiences, you know, walk you through a solution to your problem. So whether that's an anniversary gift for your wife, you know, where I should spend $3,000, you know, $2,000 on my next big trip, or, you know, something really highly productive for my work. So whether it's, you know, whether it has to do with Microsoft Excel or PowerPoint or Salesforce CRM or Photoshop, you know, where, gosh, you know, I have a big presentation to make, and Google and the content that's just out there on the web is actually not going to be too helpful right now. I'd rather talk to a real expert, you know. So potentially that's the hypothesis, right? And it should be the same for content, that like the more important, you know, if you're only going to read X books or, you know, X thousands of words this month, potentially you want to talk to a person about that.
Right.
You know?
So let me ask you one last kind of, I think we're at a point where I need to ask you one last question for this conversation. What would you say right now? What's the book or the text or the website that is really moving you? You know, what story is really the one you would recommend as the thing that's, you know, just top of mind right now, making you really motivated?
That's great. That's a great question. It's sort of like what would be my opportunity to curate, you know, for today. I have to admit something to you, David. I like, you know, I won't name names, but I actually say this to a lot of my friends in the storytelling industry. And as you know, I traverse a lot of different industries, but, and they thankfully have agreed with me. I'm not asking you to necessarily volunteer your, opinion on this or the fact of it from you, but I will say that I am sort of, classically in the middle of like 9 books at a time always. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's just who I've always been or the generation that I come from. Sadly, not a lot of finished books in the last month, but like 9 or 12 that I'm sort of halfway through. I will say that, so my parents are from the Philippines, and I was brought up here. Actually, I was born here. My girlfriend is also Filipino-American. She was born and raised there. She was about 6. Her name is Mia Alvar, and she's a short story writer. And she recommended to me a book of short stories. You know, there was that great, interesting, very controversial article recently about like sort of the rebirth of the short story collection. You know?
Yes, yes.
Like, you know, we should talk about maybe next time or when we catch the Yankee game. I'd love to get your take on it. But Lisley Tenorio wrote a really wonderful collection called Monstrous, which I did finish. And I'm happy to say that that's definitely something that if you care about short fiction at all and you're interested in a set of stories that sort of, you know, might touch on sort of a place and time, you know, traversing the Philippines that you might not know about, that's definitely one that'd be high on my list. That came out last year.
All right. Well, that's great. Actually, that gives me, I mean, I, like you, I have probably between 8 and 10 books open and reading at the same time at any given time, and not all of them get finished, but I'm, for, you know, just like anybody else, if you tell me about a great new book, I'm going to go out and buy it. So I will go, I will buy Monstrous, and the next time we talk, we can talk about that.
Awesome. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me today. This was really fun, and you know, I'm looking forward to more conversations that are not recorded or recorded.
Thanks, Glenn. I really appreciate it. Thanks for coming on Publishing Talks and talking about the future, and I think it is the future of publishing. This is David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Glenn Nano. Thanks so much.
Thank you.